Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. So I just heard the bells strike 9 o'clock at St. Paul's, which is where we are today in Paternoster Square. And if I asked you what is the London Stock Exchange Group, or LSEG, most investors would answer, well, it's the London Stock Exchange, of course. And the answer was, wrong, that's only 5% of revenues today. And you'd pause and wonder what the rest is. So today we're going to examine an organisation with revenues of over £8 billion, operating income of nearly £3 billion, a market cap of £50 billion, the 14th largest company in the UK, employing 25,000 people in 70 countries, and is owned 4% today by Microsoft. Plenty has changed since its inception in Sweeting's Alley in the City of London in 1801. And here to discuss approach, vision and opportunities is a veteran of 20 years at Goldman Sachs and CEO since 2018. David Schwimmer, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Great to be here.
Another of your Goldman predecessors, Xavier Rolli, was an earlier guest who also was CEO of the LSEG, as I've got to remember to call your group today. But as I looked at your history pre-finance, I see you studied English at Yale. I have to ask you, did you grow up in a house with lots of books?
Yeah, there was a lot of reading. Yeah, I guess I would say there were a lot of books. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but... Reading was encouraged, TV was discouraged. So I guess the answer would have to be yes.
Very good. Okay, I'm going to give you an early test here. Do you know which Dickens book features the London Stock Exchange?
You know, I should know the answer to that, especially because my father's favorite author was Dickens.
Really?
Yeah, but I think maybe perhaps because of that, he was always reading Dickens, especially on vacations. He would plow through one book after the other. So maybe as a reaction to that, I have not been a big Dickens reader.
Well, I'm going to take you away from your agony. And that is actually that in The Christmas Carol, the ghost takes Scrooge to a series of strange places, including the London Stock Exchange, where a group of businessmen discussing the death of a rich man. So there we go.
Guess I'll have to put it on the reading list.
You also then study law and become a lawyer at Davis Polk from 96 to 98 now. Mm-hmm. So as we plot journeys of folks like you, it's always intriguing whether life just tilts you in another direction. But was the plan to be a lawyer, or was that just a step along the way?
I found law and a potential career in law to be really interesting. I loved law school. I thought law school was fascinating and intellectually really a great place. And so when I went to practice law, I thought, yeah, I could be a lawyer. But after a couple of years of doing that, I clearly considered some other things. I was working with a bunch of bankers at that point, and one of them asked me to apply to Goldman Sachs, and there I went shortly thereafter.
We had a similar story with Manny Roman, who runs PIMCO, who was obviously another Goldman's alum, who was starting on academia before he was drawn into the world of finance. But there is this pivot you make to join LSEG in 2018. So let's just talk about your organization. How do you describe the LSE Group today?
So we're the world's leading provider of financial market infrastructure and data and analytics. We operate on a global basis. We serve our customers across asset classes and across the trade lifecycle. So by trade lifecycle, I mean pre-trade, trade, post-trade. And we provide all the data and analytics to serve our customers, our users, across each of those parts of the trade lifecycle. So it is a broad, diversified ecosystem in many ways in terms of providing participants in the financial markets so much in terms of what they need in data, workflow, execution capabilities.
So let's talk about those client constituents, because you are in, and some of this really surprised me, and I thought I knew, you know, a little bit about what was going on in your business, but you are providing FX services, you're providing clearing services, data services. Let's just dive into some of those, because stock exchange, as we talked about earlier on, is only one part of it. Can we talk about what clients come to you for?
So maybe I'll spend a moment just talking about the different parts of the business,
right,
because our clients come to us for a lot. In terms of our capital markets business, that includes equity trading, so the London Stock Exchange, but also a multilateral trading facility, Turquoise. We have foreign exchange trading, both dealer-to-dealer and dealer-to-customer, one of the leading foreign exchange trading venues in the world, FXall and Matching. We are one of the leading fixed income trading venues in the world. We have a controlling stake in the public company TradeWeb, and that is core to our fixed income trading capabilities. That's all within our capital markets business. We then have our post-trade business, which is largely the London Clearinghouse, LCH, which is actually a clearinghouse both in the UK and also in France. And we have leading position in clearing of, in particular, over-the-counter derivatives, where we have 90% plus market share in the clearing of interest rate swaps, but we also clear credit derivatives. We also clear government bonds and repos. We clear equities. We clear foreign exchange. And that is a super systemic asset regulated in jurisdictions all over the world and a huge credit counterparty to most major global banks. We also have different parts of our data and analytics capabilities. So we are the number one provider in the world of real-time data. We're one of the leading providers in the world of non-real-time data. We have the FTSE Russell Index business. We have a risk intelligence business, which is one of the leading providers in the world of the data, the content set that banks and others use to do background checks, KYC, AM, Know Your Customer, and anti-money laundering. And I've left out a number of other aspects of the business, but that gives you a sense of the range, the breadth, the depth of our offering.
And if you took something like fixed income, and for many people listening will know, but some won't, it's a broke market. It has never been historically exchanged like trading on the New York Stock Exchange or the London Stock Exchange. How does a market like that evolve, and how do you get your footprint sort of, you know, central to people transacting?
So one of the fascinating developments in market infrastructure, really over the last, I'll call it, now 25 or so years, has been the electronification of trading. And much of the trading that took place in the world in different asset classes, you know, there's the cliche imagery of people yelling at each other on a trading floor. And you had that in a number of different asset classes. And that really, around the turn of this century, moved more and more towards electronic trading. And that pace was faster or slower depending on the asset class. In some products, and particularly fixed income, a lot of the trading activity still takes place over the phone, or what's known as voice brokerage. And what TradeWeb has done, our fixed income execution platform, has been a real leader in the transformation and the transition of that space really over the last 20 years from that voice brokerage to electronic trading. And you can see it at different stages, again, in different asset classes. So, for example, in terms of treasuries, a lot of it has moved to electronic. In terms of some other asset classes like high yield, that is less electronic, in part because it's more bespoke. So the technological changes in that industry have also been a big driver of change, and lots of opportunity for innovation, lots of opportunity for disruption in an asset class like that. But that's one of a number of asset classes that have seen this kind of disruption over the last 20 plus years.
And if you were being, I suppose, cynical, but some actually would say realistic, is a world hooked on debt is not going to stop issuing more and more. So sitting at the epicenter of those flows is strategically probably a very good place to be.
Well, the two largest traded asset classes are fixed income and foreign exchange. And so our leadership positions in each of those, I think, position us very well given that activity.
And funnily enough, we're going to come back to London as a financial hub later on, but I think people forget how central London is to the FX world. But we're going to pause on that. I was talking to William Vericker, who's on your board. He's chairman of Santander UK. And he said, you've got to understand that, you know, LSEG is a tech company. Now, you've hinted at this disintermediation that's occurring everywhere in your business. Just help us who are not tech people, I'm talking about myself, understand how technology is being incorporated into your businesses. And you may want to then lead into the fact that Microsoft has become a shareholder. So I'm going to open it for you to talk about.
Happy to touch on each of the different aspects of that. So if you take a step back and you look at the development of the financial sector, you don't have to go back too far. And in many ways, a lot of companies still think this way, in that technology is sort of a back office service or provider to the front office, where you have, you know, whether it might be traders on trading desks or bankers doing activity or wealth managers engaging in their activity. In many ways, for us, as a service provider to all of those different market participants in all of those different functions, our product has become more and more the technology. And so whether we are an execution venue, i.e. a source of liquidity or a clearinghouse or a data provider, in each case, that product is very fundamentally driven by technology. And so our technology has in many ways become our product. And that is only going to continue. So we of course have a lot of great people with a lot of really impressive subject matter expertise. That was one thing that I was really impressed by when I arrived at LSEG in 2018, the level of expertise that our people have across a broad range of different aspects. You've been in this industry for a long time. You know how much specificity, in some cases, how much arcane detail is necessary to navigate the different parts of the business. And we have expertise in many, many different areas, from the clearing of credit derivatives to a vast array of data and analytics that serve the industry. So we're not just a technology company. We have an extraordinary set of talent among our people. But it is more and more that combination of that subject matter expertise and the provision of the technological capabilities to our customers.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsors. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description. In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more, or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market. So when we think about a firm like Microsoft and your involvement with them, what does each expect of the other?
So we have a great partnership with Microsoft. We announced it in December of 22. The world has changed a lot even since then. We announced our partnership with Microsoft, I think a few weeks after ChatGPT arrived in the world. And I would say a few different aspects of this. We are building product together. We're building product together in a few different areas, ranging from embedding our data and analytics and workflow, really our desktop offering, into the Microsoft Teams and 365 productivity suite. And that has an opportunity, we have not launched this yet, but that has an opportunity to transform how our industry communicates, how people interact with each other, how people access data, how people extract insight from their data. We are also moving our many different data sets built up over literally decades among our heritage companies, whether Reuters, Thomson, Thomson Reuters, Refinitiv, now LSEG. And we are the leader in terms of the breadth and depth of our data, really unmatched in terms of our data. But the ability for our customers to use it is somewhat constrained by how it has been built up architecturally over the years. So we're moving that into an integrated architecture in a cloud environment that will make it very, very much, I'll say, simpler, easier for our customers to access. And then we're also building certain analytics capabilities, again, with Microsoft. So we're doing each of these different product builds with the benefit of Microsoft's tech capability, AI functionality. In other words, that AI functionality will be embedded in the products that we are building. We often get the question, why is Microsoft doing this with us? Mm-hmm. And I should let Microsoft speak for themselves, but in many ways, I think Microsoft views us as their gateway to the financial sector. We work with almost every major bank in the world. We work with almost every major asset manager in the world. We work with many corporates, governments, et cetera, asset owners. And we're highly regulated. And we're very comfortable being highly regulated. We view interacting with regulators as a core competency. Microsoft is not regulated in the financial sector. I would imagine they're not eager to be regulated in the financial sector. So it's actually been a great partnership. I should also mention we have Scott Guthrie, who's Microsoft's head of cloud and AI, on our board. Terrific to have him on our board, having that insight in the boardroom. And the partnership also has brought us, I'll say, cultural benefits in that Microsoft is one of the world's leading technology companies, world-class at building technology-enabled product. And so for our teams to be working really hand in glove together is fantastic for the cultural transformation that we are going through.
Got it. So before we leave tech, lots of chat about AI, not a pun intended there, but could you maybe give us an example of how you expect embedding AI in one of those businesses? Just give us an example of what that might mean. And we're really seeking here to understand how, you know, AI, other than a clever tool, is a productivity-enhancing mechanism.
I will give you an example of that that is coming very soon. We are actually rolling out the pilot of this product with a few of our customers really over the next few weeks. And it's a product called Meeting Prep. I think everyone in the business world and many other worlds knows about preparing for a meeting and doing the research or pulling together information for a meeting. What this product does, it takes your information as you're preparing for a meeting. It takes your information from your emails, your files, and your client relationship management system, your CRM system, combines it with our data, public info, corporate info, news, financial metrics, and puts that into a briefing memo using generative AI, large language model technology. And it writes that memo for you in significantly less time than I have just spent describing it.
Got it.
So you can see how that could be an extraordinary efficiency in terms of all of the time that people spend in preparing for a meeting. That is just an example that we happen to be piloting over the next few weeks. But there is lots more that we are doing and building. And I'll say the real magic of this is taking our data, our information, our understanding of workflow in the financial sector, which can be somewhat obscure or hard to understand for the outside world, and combining that with the AI functionality that allows a person to basically use natural language to ask for information. And we have not had that in our industry over the last 20 plus years. In many ways, technology has created more complexity. And this will be creating greater simplicity.
And a much more general question as I listen to you is, do you actually think that AI is the job-destroying technology that some would have it? Or how would you nuance it?
I think it will replace some jobs. I think it will make other jobs a lot more efficient. And I think it will create new jobs or change existing jobs. I also think it's hard to predict exactly how this will play out. And I think it is very powerful technology that will continue to develop and change over the coming years. But that would be my base case.
I'm only going to ask you a few tricky questions along the way, but I want to turn back to London. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's a function of my age, but there is a relentless diet of bad news in this country that is regurgitated by the papers that I'm almost giving up on, you know, and it's a peculiar British thing. We talk about the fact that Americans celebrate success and Europeans and the UK tend to sort of stigmatize failure. But I get the impression, listening to people, the narrative and the facts diverge in terms of the bearish UK case. Let's just hear it from you, what you're seeing.
So I agree with you that there are some significant differences in terms of how the different cultures approach success, approach failure. There is a sense in, you know, I'm American. I grew up in the US. I think in that culture, failure happens. I wouldn't say it's celebrated, but it's accepted and it's understood that you get up and you move on. And if you succeed after failure, if anything, that's almost celebrated more. But success is celebrated in a U.S. culture. I think probably risk aversion is a better way to think about that. And thus, if you are seen as taking risk and trying to succeed in certain areas, maybe the risk is less appreciated here. And thus, the success might be less appreciated here as well. But I think we view ourselves as a global company. We're taking an approach. We've taken a lot of risk over the last few years. And I think there was a lot of skepticism about it, a lot of criticism of what we had been doing. And as we have come through the last few years and really demonstrated a healthy transformation of LSEG, you know, perhaps we'll hear a little bit less of the skeptics, but...
So I want to broaden it because, of course, you know, you're one microcosm that you seem to have successfully executed a number of these transformatory deals that we talked about in terms of your sources of revenue. But one of the favorites that the journalistic community wants to talk about is the absence of listings in the UK. I'm sitting on a couple of asset allocation meetings. I was listening to Cambridge Associates, who are a highly regarded consultancy, say the other day on a call, I think they were in Boston, that it's the worst IPO market in the US for 25 years. But of course, you don't hear that in the UK. And then the other trotted out commentary is that, you know, US companies receive these high valuations. And I was actually meeting at Rothschilds not so long ago where some of their corporate finances had shown that that isn't over the medium term necessarily the case. Technology, you know, aside. When it comes to companies listing and that discussion, just give us a flavor of how CEOs are thinking about listing and that whole, you know, not just process, because I saw BAT's CEO was out there saying, well, of course we wouldn't move from London, but just give us a sense of what people are saying and thinking.
Yes. So, and I've spoken a bit about this publicly. I referred to some of these, I used the word myth, some of these beliefs that the media and others have been trotting out there. And they are, in fact, myths. And yet I think the important thing to understand, just a couple aspects. You touched on the fact that it is a very weak market for IPOs globally, and that you have seen delistings in different markets globally. And if you look at the statistics and you compare delistings in New York and you compare them to delistings in London, you know, they're roughly comparable. And yet the narrative is, London is having a crisis of delisting. Similarly, the valuation question, there's this sort of false impression out there, and it's often perpetuated regularly in what I'll describe as credible media,
yes,
that there's some massive discount in London compared to companies that are listed in New York. And just, I'll give you one example of why this is almost a ridiculous or silly thing to be talking about. The London Stock Exchange is the most international capital market in the world by far. One of the aspects of that is that roughly 40% of the investment capital that comes into companies listed on the London Stock Exchange is from the US. So if we really had a 30 or 40% discount here, wouldn't the US investors who are already here just arbitrage that away? Now, you could have discussions on around the edges of that in terms of, well, there's a lot more retail flow in the US, which is true. And so as prices are driven by the marginal investor, yeah, you could have maybe in certain circumstances a modest differential. But we have way too many kind of smart global investors who, if there were really that kind of a dramatic discount, the capital is mobile and would just close that discount. So I think, again, that's just one example of where there has developed this narrative that is really a false narrative. So from our perspective, the IPO environment, I mentioned this in our results a couple of weeks ago, we see the pipeline in this market looking more encouraging than it has in the last few years. And I think some of that is just market driven. I think companies need to raise capital. Companies will want to go public. I think there has been a lot of geopolitical uncertainty over the last couple of years, a lot of uncertainty around the macro environment, inflation rates, et cetera. But as you know, the equity markets are cyclical. IPO markets open and they shut. So topic that gets a lot of attention, sometimes the understanding is not as sophisticated as it should be.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsors. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Yeah, and I had a meeting last night, actually, with Dominic Freemantle, who's a senior Morgan Stanley European leader. And he was saying that after being quite dormant, suddenly there's a lot of activity in the pipeline, which is very encouraging. It's a global phenomenon. But before we leave that, we talked about foreign exchange, and there is a propensity, perhaps it's the equity community, to talk about companies and listing, not listing. We touched on foreign exchange, and as countries get richer and they need to, you know, their GDP grows, so their currencies become, you know, more center stage. Talk a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of London's position vis-a-vis capturing FX and even fixed income flows.
So in many ways, London continues to be a world leader in terms of fixed income trading, in terms of FX trading. There have been some, I'll say, bumps in the road associated with Brexit, where, for example, the trading of certain derivatives that took place in London, the EU, from a regulatory perspective, did not want EU trading houses trading those in London. Now, they're in the sort of realm of unintended consequences. A lot of that volume did not go to the EU. A lot of it went to the US. So there have been, as I said, some bumps in the road in terms of some aspects of the massive amount of liquidity that has historically traded in London. But I think across different asset classes, and FX being a big one, London continues to be the global leading center.
So the other phenomenon, we were lucky enough to have Michael Mubisam from Columbia Business School on the show talking about the fact that companies are staying private for longer. Mm-hmm. It's a global phenomenon. I think 11 years now versus 20 years ago, it might have been 7 or 8. But so companies are staying private for longer for lots of reasons that anybody wants to know the answer to. They need to listen to that podcast that we did. And therefore, we're seeing the growth of some alternative mechanisms to deal with that. NASDAQ private markets in the US. And here there is this, if I've got it right, the intermittent trading venue. I may have my name. I'm happy to be corrected. It happens all the time. Tell a little bit about how the LSE group is thinking about that cohort of businesses.
So really interesting area. And this venue has been referred to as the intermittent trading venue. The government has recently put out a name of PICES, private intermittent securities and capital exchange system, I think. But the basic concept is that historically we have had this sort of bright line between private companies that aren't really expected to trade or have any liquidity, and then public companies that trade and have liquidity on exchanges. And what this trading venue will do is it will basically break down that bright line or that barrier between the two. And the construct is basically that you can have a private company and be publicly trade it. In other words, take advantage of our public market infrastructure for a day. And then you can go back to being a private company. So how would this work? You might have a private company. You want to give some liquidity to either some of the early investors in it or some of the employees in it. And you put out a disclosure document that might be, that would be less onerous than a public disclosure document. And you make the announcement that we will be available for trading on the London Stock Exchange's public market trading infrastructure on this date in, call it mid-April. The date comes, you have an opportunity for liquidity in the shares. You have all kinds of control over it that you might not have for a public company. In other words, you could price limitations if you don't want it to go below a certain level. You can set access limitations if you don't want your competitors to access the disclosure document or various other things. And also, this is unlikely to be available for retail investors. This will be for sophisticated investors. Once you do that, then that day passes, shares are exchanged, you go back to being a private company. And you may make a commitment to come back to the public markets once a year, once every 6 months, whatever might make sense from the perspective of your company and your capital structure. And it's very differentiated. You mentioned some other companies that have had private share trading in the past. What's differentiating about this is that market participants who have access today to the London Stock Exchange, which is most major investors in the world, whether they're direct members or through intermediaries, they can have access to this company, as opposed to a lot of the other execution venues in private markets have their own separate connectivity, and you have to sign up for that. So it's a very elegant way of providing access to global investors, traditionally public market investors, for a private company, and again, getting the benefits of public market infrastructure. And we look forward to, we are hoping to launch this year. At this point, we're really waiting for regulatory approval.
Great. Now, let's just imagine that I'm the CEO of a company in here meeting you, thinking about a listing wherever I might be. What's your pitch? Why should I, as the CEO of ABC Corporation that meets the requirements that you would want me listing, what's your pitch?
Well, we have, as I mentioned earlier, the most international capital market in the world by far. And so in terms of investors, we have investors from the U.S., the largest capital market. We have investors from Europe. We have investors from Asia. There are different kinds of risk appetites in this market and different kinds of areas of focus in this market. But to your question about private markets, if you're a private company, we will, of course, welcome you as a public company. But if you are not sure if you're actually ready to be a public company, that's the benefit of this particular offering in the intermittent trading venue. So we can serve customers across that public to private spectrum. And I think the opportunity set as a public company is great here. Global access to investors, liquidity, and significant opportunity. But if you are a private company and may want to remain private, we can serve you in that market as well. There's one other point I just wanted to make on your initial comment about private companies and how we've had an explosion of private companies over the last 10, 20 years. And that's, of course, been accompanied by the explosion of private capital, which has been sourced from free money.
Yes.
And so I think there's sometimes a point that the markets also have lost sight of a little bit. If this new era the normalized era.
Quite right.
Where money actually costs something, persists, then you could argue that we are coming to the end of a very long cycle, call it a 20-year cycle, that has been very supportive of private capital. And so I don't think people often think in terms of 20-year cycles, but clearly that is what we have been through from an interest rate perspective. And I think it raises some very interesting questions. The conventional wisdom is that, well, private capital, much more attractive than public capital. We'll see. In other words, we may be on the cusp of a shift in that dynamic as, and we're already seeing some of the challenges that the private equity sector is facing as the era of free money has apparently come to an end. So I just think it's, as I look at this whole dynamic and the opportunity set that we see out there with private companies, public companies, this perception that has really shifted the preference towards private may tilt back over time.
I think it's a really good point. And, you know, investors generally have a habit of extrapolating the last decade rather than placing things in proper historical context. But the debate rages that the UK is failing to attract growth capital, you know, because pension funds in the UK have divested for all sorts of reasons. And so their UK equity allocations are sub 3%. What do you see that encourages you that, should we call it growth capital, but, you know, is inbound rather than only going out?
So actually, the UK has a great growth ecosystem. And if you look at the universities here, if you look at all sorts of statistics around the number of unicorns here, the fintech, biotech, and it has been a great environment for the development of some terrific companies. Now, some of them have stayed and some of them have either been acquired, and then some of them have gone to list in other jurisdictions. So one of the aspects of this whole discussion that I think has been actually pretty helpful over the past couple of years is a focus by the government and by the regulators, by the FCA, on the ecosystem here in terms of really supporting those companies that have grown up here so that they can continue to develop here, attract capital here, and go on to be either publicly listed with us or continue to be based here, headquartered in the UK, and support the UK economy. Some of the aspects of that kind of change are really modernizing the listings regime. And there are aspects of the listings regime that over the years have become, I'll say, less competitive than they should be. Some things like, and this quickly gets into some corporate governance arcana, but it's important if you're a company thinking about listing, related party transactions. In some other jurisdictions, you just have to have disclosure around it and perhaps a vote amongst independent directors. In this jurisdiction, historically, we have had to have a shareholder vote, which is a much more of a burden. And so that is being changed as part of some of the modernization of the listings requirements. And there are plenty of other examples along those lines, but no need to go into those. I think another aspect, so a more, I'll say, simplified, better regulatory environment and listing regime, I think will be helpful. You touched on the pension discussion here in the UK. This is a really interesting one. It won't be fixed overnight, but the UK pension sector is the second largest in the world. Huge amount of capital in the UK pension sector. And yet, if you asked an international investor to name two or three UK pension funds, I think they would struggle. If you ask an international investor to mention two or three Canadian pension funds, probably no problem.
Yes, yes.
Because
yes.
In Canada, which is a smaller country with a smaller pension sector, they have consolidated world-class, professionally managed pension funds that are globally renowned investors. And in the UK, you have, I think the average pension fund size is £300 million, and there are thousands of them.
That's an interesting point.
Yes. So this is a topic that we have been talking about with the government and with many other stakeholders. And I think there's an opportunity in this market to drive, and this is complicated, but to drive consolidation of pension funds so that they are able to take advantage of the benefits of scale, to raise the bar, if I can put it that way, in terms of really attracting world-class management capability, and then have lower cost structure but higher returns for their investors. And that raises some really interesting questions then about, well, do you require them to invest in the UK, a certain amount of their capital in the UK? And I think the government and others are very sensitive about the notion of directing that investment capital. But if you look at it holistically, if are there tax benefits to these pension funds from the government? Is the capital coming from people who live here? And should some of that capital be recycled to benefit the people who live and work here? So there are some complicated, important issues in that discussion. But I think this is an area where if the policy is executed in the right way, you can have more capital, more growth capital invested in important areas in this country, in infrastructure, among others. And at the same time, and probably the most important aspect of this is benefiting the pensioners, giving the pensioners higher returns relative to many years of heavy investment in fixed income.
So that's a really good point. And one of the reasons that IFM, the institutional investors from Australia, have, you know, got a big push going on here in Europe is because of the infrastructure as an asset class. I don't think people understand that point you just made, because funny you say Canada, we had Ontario Teachers on as a guest. I've just recorded with CPP. But, you know, this fragmentation in the UK is absolutely astonishing. But one of the problems, it appears to me, has been this rather curious aspect of the UK wanting to celebrate capitalism and then not pay their leaders enough. And I sort of stand back and I go, you know, it's a global race for talent. And are we making progress on that rather painful front of if you want to hire a smart person, you got to pay them, they've got to perform, but we should be able to pay them and it shouldn't be, you know, restrained or capped or looked at in some sort of way that, you know, this is vulgar.
This is another, I'll say, complicated social issue in many ways. And the UK and London in particular, clearly there's an ambition here for London to be a globally competitive financial center. And yet there is a social norm here, and I would say a particularly tricky and challenging social norm over the last several years when we have had real economic difficulty for large portions of the population. But there has been a social norm here that executives at companies, listed companies, should be paid at a certain level that is significantly below that of the U.S. And you see this reflected in the proxy advisors, the ISSs of the world, where they apply different standards in this market to the standards that they apply in the U.S. So I think the challenge then is, if you are a company based here that is competing with companies in the U.S., either in your markets or for talent, then you have to be able to attract world-class talent. And so this difference in social norms around compensation does become competitively constraining in this market. And this is a topic of regular discussion amongst boards, amongst REMCO chairs. And I think, as you just touched on, we have been involved in trying to raise the discussion around this and really highlight the fact that if London is going to be a globally competitive center, if you want world-class companies to list here, then we need to have compensation norms that are globally competitive. And again, I say this with a recognition of all of the challenges and social ramifications of it, but that's an ongoing discussion, an ongoing debate.
And I know that people love to think there's a silver bullet for all these things, but what would be the one or two things, if you were in a position of power to influence it at a governmental level, that you would want to see enforced?
I'm not sure that this is a governmental issue.
Okay.
I think that obviously there's the governance code here, which has been evaluated, but you have an ongoing conversation in this market among investors. I think it's an important issue for investors, and the Investment Association has weighed in on this and recognized there may be a need to adjust the approach. I think it's an important issue for the media, because a lot of companies and executives are wary of running afoul of the media here and being subject to criticism of the media here. So I think the approach, and our CEO of the London Stock Exchange, Julia Hoggett, made some comments around this last year that helped catalyze the conversation. And we've seen others participate in the discussion. And again, I don't pretend it's an easy conversation, given the social aspects of it. But I think it's important that people are engaging on it. And fundamentally, it comes down to the shareholders. You know, the media will have their views, either pro or con. The proxy agencies will have their views. They may be inconsistent with their views of how it should play out in the U.S. But fundamentally, this is something for the shareholders to weigh in on. And I think the structure that we have here in the UK allows shareholders to weigh in on it.
So I'm going to move to some general questions. One is on leadership. I heard you say that it's more important to be respected than to be liked, which I thought was a very wise comment. Describe your leadership style.
But I may answer. I'm not sure if it implicates the respected versus liked dichotomy. But I think I like to surround myself with people who are much better than I am, and then have them execute in each of their different areas of focus or expertise. I do like to drill down periodically into the different areas to understand what's going on. And that's much more out of interest, and it's really important to me to understand what's going on in the business than it is out of sort of a tendency to micromanage. And so I try to create an environment where there's that kind of open communication about the good and the bad, because there's always good and bad in big, complex organizations.
So just going higher level, you know corporate finance, you know capital markets, you know data flows. What do you see as the most significant challenge for the financial services industry in the next decade?
I think so. Technology is a really interesting challenge and opportunity. I'm actually pretty excited about the direction of travel for the industry from a tech perspective. And it gets back to a little bit of what I was saying earlier, where technology has made the financial sector more and more complex over the last 20 years. And there has been more and more to sort of sift through, and more information, more and more technology protocols, almost too much. And I think we're now at a potential turning point where technology could make things easier. If you think about the ability of generative AI to kind of allow humans to interact with data in a very different way, in a consolidating and simplifying way, I think that's very powerful. So I'm excited about what we could see from technology over the coming years. But another aspect of your question, I think one of the big challenges for this sector is to get the balance right around risk taking. And there's so much discussion, and this, we probably don't want to go too far down the path of technical regulation, but particularly coming out of the financial crisis in 2007, 2008, you saw a very significant profusion and change in terms of the regulatory environment. And we've seen that in different markets, in the US, in the EU, in the UK. And I think we're now seeing how the different jurisdictions have, in many ways, adjusted to that shift in risk appetite. And I'm not sure we have it right in different areas. And the US has just had a lot of discussion about bank capital requirements. I think the FCA, as part of their market review, in terms of some of the reforms that they are considering, has talked about whether investors may have to take more responsibility for navigating risk as opposed to being protected by the regulators. And I think thematically, that's a big, important issue. How paternalistic is the government from a regulatory perspective versus how much do we allow and trust investors to manage and take risk? And again, not an easy question. I think the whole financial crisis really was seen as a failure of risk management. But the pendulum does swing in regulation, in risk appetite. So I think you put this question in the context of the next 10 years, I think it will be very interesting to see how that pendulum swings and if we are better at finding the balance of risk, regulation, and what the sort of balance of that is in different jurisdictions.
So I'm going to move to close here, David. And I discovered as we did the research that you are a passionate historian. We've actually been lucky enough to have Peter Frangipane and Andrew Roberts and Nell Ferguson on. But so my question is, which current historian and at which historic place would you like to have dinner with them?
Oh, wow. Well, I am a big Robert Caro fan. And so I guess I would have to say I'd be happy to have a discussion with him. I wouldn't be too concerned about the location. And for those who aren't familiar with him, he wrote The Power Broker about Robert Moses in 20th century New York, one of the most powerful figures who was never elected. And then he has written a multi-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson, and he is still working on the last volume, and his fans around the world are eagerly awaiting the arrival of that. So that would probably be a fascinating discussion. But he writes history as a novelist, I guess that's what I would say, just like a fantastic writer.
Great. Well, we stay with historians. We've got hopefully Neil Ferguson coming back, who's finishing Kissinger Part 2 right now, so hopefully we'll have him later in the year. And finally, on the subject of advice and following that book of the name, if you could tell us just one thing, one piece of advice.
This question comes up a lot from young people
right.
who are getting into their careers. And what I tell them is do not set your own limits. So many people don't try to do certain things because they think they might fail. And so they don't even try. And I think that is a really important constraint to avoid. So one other, if I may. Is, and I think this is particularly relevant in the current era where you see so much short-termism and you see, you know, whether it's social media or any other cultural aspects, attention spans are very, very short. And so I would say invest the time. Generally, you know, you asked about history, or I can't claim to be a historian, but I love reading about history. And just the notion of, you know, reading a book that's 800 pages in this day and age, like most people just don't even consider it because it's viewed as, how would I ever spend that amount of time doing something? And yet I think in terms of finding real opportunity, finding real understanding, finding real value in things, it often takes time. So I would say invest the time. Try to extract yourself from the world of short-termism for enough time to really consider some of those things.
Very wise, and I definitely need to have note to self on that front. Lots of things I've written down and thought about, but I'm just going to say two. One is, the London Stock Exchange Group, LSEG, is not the company that many people think it is and was. And you've been very clear on how you're sitting at the epicenter of so many flows in these global capital markets in ways that many of us didn't understand. But you made another point, which I've railed against super cheap money and central banks being behind the curve, but the proliferation of private equity, courtesy of mispriced capital, has, of course, created an asset class none of us could have imagined. But, the pendulum swims as well, and the disaffection with public markets may prove to be cyclical and less structural. And I know that you sit in a place where you hope that happens, but I can absolutely see that there are a lot of reasons that might well happen. So, David, really enjoyed meeting you today, sitting here in these, lovely offices at the centre of historic part of London and sharing your thoughts with us. So thank you.
Thank you, Simon. Great to have the discussion with you.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.